Our guest is Irving Fine, Jack Benny's personal manager and producer for some 28 years and author of about the best biography I've ever written, Jack Benny, An Intimate Biography, published by Putnam. Irving Fine, I guess you were more than his personal manager. You were more like a friend to Jack Benny, weren't you?
Well, I was a friend, and I wasn't his personal manager for 28 years. You know, I was with him for 28 years in various capacities. I started off as director of advertising and publicity for a company he had. And then I ended up as we formed our own company many years later, and I became president of that company, J&M Productions, and we produced other television programs as well as the Jack Benny program. And I became executive producer of our weekly television programs. And then the last 10 years of his life, I became his, when we finished that weekly program, I became executive producer of his specials. And then I became his personal manager, and I became his business manager. He didn't have a business manager at that time. And I became his, I still was his press agent. I still was his, I became his musical director, even though I knew nothing about music. But I knew
well, how much do you have to know about Love and Bloom?
Well, no, we had more music in the act. Yeah. Jack would play medleys, and he would do other things. And the B, and he would play Getting to Know You and things like that with a little girl violinist. But I learned the music, and I knew his part. And I could do the whole rehearsal without him. I knew how the music went, and I could tell the orchestra leader how to do it and when to break and when to stop and what tempo to do. And Jack used to be amazed that I could do the rehearsal, the music rehearsal, knowing I knew nothing about music.
Were you with Jack when he was in Chicago a few years ago at the Mill Run?
Yes, I was. I was with Jack all the time. We traveled all over the world together. We traveled to Australia together for a month. We went to England. We went to Ireland, all over Canada. We went to Mexico City together. And I would say we traveled practically to every city in the United States.
Well, while you were rehearsing the orchestra at the Mill Run, I was interviewing him backstage a couple of years back when he was there. So I'm glad that you did a good job so I could get a nice chance to chat and meet him.
Yeah, well, we used to do that. We used to save time. Jack used to do newspaper interviews while I would rehearse the orchestra. It would save a lot of time.
Your book is just filled with fascinating stories about Jack Benny and about your association with him as well. You mentioned that you started out, you were doing some publicity work for him. You pulled a pretty goodly number of publicity stunts that a lot of people didn't have much faith in, but finally packed them in, didn't they?
Well, we did all kinds of things. The first big problem we had was to, when Bill Paley moved him from NBC to CBS, it was the beginning of 1949. We had a big problem to let the audience know that he had moved to a new station and all over the country. And, you know, habit is very important in people's lives. And you never know when people will leave you because of habit. And we worked hard, and I worked with CBS, and we did all kinds of things to let people know he moved. And when he did move, he not only remained number one, but he even had a higher rating than when he was on NBC.
But isn't there an episode in the book about a couple of gimmicks that you pulled as a PR man, as
well,
a press
agent?
We did
in those days, when we started television, all the studios, motion picture and television studios and shows, used to open shows with a big party afterwards in New York. They used to take over the 21 Club or El Morocco or the Four Seasons and have big, lavish, expensive parties where they invite the press and spend fortunes of money to entertain them. And one year, we, because of Jack's thrift image, we took over the Automat. The Automat, which is, you know, you put 10 cents or 15 cents into a slot and get a sandwich. And we took over the Automat. And Jack Benny, we sent out engraved invitations, and we were the black tie party. And we had a red carpet out, and Rolls Royces would pull up, and we had all the stars on Broadway and the press come to this party. And it got front page coverage all over the United States, and it cost very little.
That's the way to go, isn't
yeah.
it?
Well, that's the trick. we do things like that, and we kept Jack alive, and we kept Jack in the public eye, and it was all good-humored things. Speaking of the Automat, Jack always loved the coffee in the Automat. He loved the pie in the Automat. But when he became a big star, he never could go to the Automat because he was afraid people would say, oh, there, see, he's really a cheap guy. He eats in the Automat. So he never could go to the Automat, and he always hated that. So that's what gave us the idea to do that Automat party so he could finally go to the Automat.
A similar story to that is related in your book from time to time, too, where Jack would find something very simple as far as a sandwich or pie and coffee, and he would just get so enthusiastic about it, he would be a sandwich maybe, the greatest of all time.
Well, Jack was very enthusiastic about all those things. And Jack would say, we go in for a hamburger. And he'd say, this is the greatest hamburger I ever had in my life. Once I tell the story in the book, we went back, I think it was 1949, for a dinner for Harry Truman when he was president of the United States. And at this dinner, all the notables in Washington were there. And after the dinner, there were a lot of private parties. But Jack said, no, I want to get a quick bite. Let's skip the parties and let's find a place to get some simple to eat. So we walked out in our evening clothes, and we walked about two or three blocks from the hotel, and we found a diner. And we went in, we had ham and eggs and coffee. Well, ham and eggs were good, but, you know, how good could ham and eggs be? But Jack said, these are the greatest ham and eggs I've ever eaten in my whole life. And he kept talking about this diner that had the greatest ham and eggs he ever had in his whole life. And then 6 years later, we were back in Washington doing a dinner for President Eisenhower. And when the dinner was over, Jack said, hey, we got to find that place for those great ham and eggs. And we went searching all over Washington. I'd forgotten where it was. We walked all over Washington in our evening clothes looking for this diner. We finally found it and had ham and eggs again.
Were they just as good?
Jack was always enthusiastic that way. One day, George Burns, in his introduction to my book, George Burns, you know, who I represent,
yes,
too.
Yes, surely. Uh-huh.
He wrote the introduction to the book. It was a very funny introduction. He's a very funny fellow.
It's excellent.
He's a funny fellow. He's a good writer. And in his introduction, he tells a story that when Jack signed a $2 million deal, he went to his lawyer's office downtown Los Angeles. And then he came back into the Hillcrest Country Club where they both belong, and he saw George. And he was all excited, and George thought he was excited about the deal. And George says, well, how are you? George, Jack said, boy, I'm so excited. You know what I found? And George said, what? He said, I found that by driving down Wilshire Boulevard at exactly 28 miles an hour, you can go right through without stopping for a red light all the way. Isn't that terrific? And he never once mentioned the $2 million deal he had signed. And that's the kind of joke. One day he met George in the club, and he said, George, have you taken a shower today? And George said, no, why? He said, you've got to take a shower. George said, why? He said, the towels are the greatest. He said, the softest, most wonderful towels. You've got to take a shower. That was Jack.
You know, Jack Benny really comes to life in your book. The dialogue in there, as I read it, I could hear Jack Benny.
Yeah, exactly. That towel story, I forgot. I didn't put that in the book. I forgot.
No, the towel story is
in there. Oh, it is in the book?
Yeah, it's in there.
I thought I'd forgotten it.
You ought to read this book. It's a good one.
Yeah. Well, I've got 1,000 great stories in the book, but every once in a while I think of something I did forget.
Yeah,
I think of great stories I forgot.
Jack Benny was a man of many moods, actually, which is something that the public would not have realized until reading your book. He was down a lot, wasn't he?
Well, sure. Aren't we all, Chuck?
Yeah.
You know, I'm down a lot, and you are. And people think their heroes are always perfect. You know, they think the president of the United States is up there smiling and signing bills and in his office and being perfect all the time. They don't realize that he's got problems in his life, and they don't realize that stars are human. And they all have moods, and Jack would get low sometimes, and when Jack would get low, he'd get lower than I would. But when he'd get high, he'd be higher than I would be, because I guess he was an artist, and artists are that way more than us normal people. They go higher and lower, you know, and when Jack would be depressed, he'd be depressed for 2-3 days sometimes, for no reason. And Jack used to tell me, he was that way all his life, even when he was a young man. He would get low for no reason, or some slight reason, and he'd be low for a day or two, and then he'd snap out of it.
He was kind of an insecure guy. With all of his success, he was always worried about the attendance at a concert or at a performance, or whether or not the last week's TV show was really up there or up to his standards?
Well, most performers are insecure, especially when you're on top, when you're number one. You worry about staying up there. You're not just one of the pack. And whether you're a mile runner, if you're a mile runner, you may be the champion, but you worry that the young guy coming along is going to run faster than you, and you train a little harder to stay up there. As you get older, you fight a little harder to be number one. And when you're in the motion picture business, you want to be a hot performer. You want every picture to be a successful picture, critically and financially. Mm-hmm. And when you're when you play a theater, you hate to go out there and see a half-empty house. It's depressing. Then you feel, gee, people don't want to see me. And it depresses you. A performer would love to go out a packed house and people can't get in. And it makes them feel good. It makes them feel wanted.
You have a story in the book about I'm not sure where it was. It was an opening, and there was a newspaper strike. And the house was really very light first night.
We played the Ziegfeld Theater in New York. Jack had wanted to go back to Broadway and do this wonderful show that we did. We did it in Las Vegas, and it was a big hit. And Jack finally said, let's go back to Broadway. And we did. We played the Ziegfeld Theater. And before we get our first ad into the New York Times, which is almost a must to get a mail order ad in the New York Times four mm-hmm. weeks before you open, just before we got our first ad in, there was a newspaper strike, and all the those days there were, I think, seven or eight newspapers in New York, and they all went out on strike. The linotype operators, mm-hmm. I think, went on strike, so no newspapers were published, and it was very difficult letting people know that you were coming to town, so that the engagement was not a great financial success, and we didn't pack them in every night, and. It was very discouraging because we had a wonderful show and people weren't coming to see it. And just as we finished the show, the strike finished. The strike was over. And so the engagement was not a success. And the reviews, the column, the critics used to write their reviews even though they weren't in the paper, because they wrote them in case the strike was over, they would put them in fast. And we saw the reviews, and the reviews were very good. It was a shame. Jack always went around and said, how about that? We had these good reviews and nobody to read them.
I can just hear him, success after success after that, he'd always bounce back to that,
sure.
that New York
sure.
episode.
Sure.
We're talking with writer Irving Fine, author Irving Fine, who wrote a great biography, an intimate biography of Jack Benny. I'd like to talk, Mr. Fine, about Jack's writers. He had a tremendous number of talented writers, didn't he? Or I should say he had a number of tremendously talented writers.
Yes, he did. And comparatively a small number of writers for his mm-hmm. long career, because there are some shows, some comedians I know in the past, in one season they would go through three, four, five sets of writers in one season. Mm-hmm. Jack had had writers for years and years and years, and then circumstances sometimes would... Well, the war came along, and two of the writers left, and he had to get new writers. And he got four new mm-hmm. writers, and they were with him for almost 20 years.
And you still call them the new writers?
No, there were two writers who came in 1950, and they were the new writers. Uh-huh. They came on as junior writers.
Uh-huh.
And then a year or two later, they became regular writers. But to Jack, they were the new writers. And they were with us for 20, 25 years. And they were always the new writers. And I imagine they were, after they were with us 18, 20 years, one day Jack said to his secretary, get me the new writers. They'd been with them 18 years. They were the new writers.
The another episode in your book about writers is really funny. I think it was that Jack Benny wanted to give some credit to Mel Blanc on a show.
Yeah.
And he went into the writers' room.
What happened was Mel Blanc played the various characters on the show. Mm-hmm. You know, he did the voice of the Maxwell. He did Anaheim, Azusa, and Cucamonga. He played the Mexican CSI routine. He did all that. He did the French violin teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And one time, it was very good in the show, and after the rehearsal on radio, Jack called the writers over from out of the booth. And he said, fellas, he said, at the end of the show, he said, I'd like to write something now to give Mel Blanc credit. I'd like to say that Mel Blanc played the part of the French violin teacher. So one of the writers said, okay, why don't you just say, at the end of the show, Mel Blanc played the part of the French violin teacher. And Jack said, yeah, that's what I'll do, and he wrote it down. And as they walked away, the four of them, one of them turned and said, Jack, one of us could have given you that line.
it's really great.
And Jack, of course, was a great audience. He fell on the floor for 10 minutes. He laughed, you know.
If I could really believe everything that's in the book, and I really...
You can. There are no lies. It's all true.
But I have to feel that Jack Benny spent 80% of his life on the floor rolling with hysterical laughter.
No, it wasn't 80%, but he spent an awful time laughing. He would laugh at everybody who was funny. And as well, people liked to be with him because people who had even mild senses of humor felt like great comedians. And comedians loved to be with him because he made them all feel number one. And the one, of course, he laughed at longest and loudest was George Burns.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And George would do crazy things to Jack. And George could do simple things to Jack. And Jack would fall on the floor. You know, George could... I tell in the book story that George, one day, Jack was wearing a blue suit. And he had a little teeny piece of thread on his lapel. And George went over and took off a piece of thread and said, "Could I borrow this thread for a while, Jack?" Well, Jack fell on the floor, you know. And he laughed and laughed. And then 2 days later, he received a package in the mail, and it was a little velvet box, and in the box was this little piece of thread, and George sent a note, says, "Thanks for lending me your thread."
And down he went again.
Yeah, Jack. And George would do that kind of thing to Jack, simple little jokes, and Jack would just think they were hilarious, and they were funny, you know.
Everyone, I'm sure, talks about Jack Benny's image of being a rather thrifty kind of a person, but indeed he was absolutely the opposite. And, in fact, he was almost extravagant, wasn't he?
Well, he was extravagant in certain things. He was extravagant to prove that he wasn't cheap.
Mm-hmm.
He would overtip. And we figured out that he would spend $7,500, $10,000 a year extra every year just to prove that he wasn't cheap by overtipping to porters, waiters, cab drivers. If we go in a restaurant where you'd ordinarily tip $2, he'd tip $8 or $6 or $5.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I say, "Jack, that's ridiculous. You know, we just had a sandwich and a cup of coffee, and the check was $2, and you left the man $6. I said, "That's ridiculous. You left him as big a tip as we ate." And Jack would say, "No, that's all right. You know, forget about it." Or when we go to the airport, where you would tip $1 for 2 bags,
mm-hmm.
let's say, for the porter. And I was with Jack, I would always tip bigger, so I would tip $2. Jack would yell at me, because I was always tipping for him. And Jack would say, "That's ridiculous, you know, give him $5, because, you know, he wanted to prove that he wasn't cheap."
I would have thought that it might be an honor to get a dime tip from Jack Benny, though.
Well, that did happen. You know, uh-huh. I tell the book, once he gave a hat check girl $1 for his hat. And she pushed it back to him and said, "Please, Mr. Benny, leave me some illusions." And once he took a cab in Las Vegas, and the ride was like 75 cents. And he gave the man $5, and he said, "Keep it." And the cab driver said, "Oh, no, I'm not going to do that. My wife would yell at me because she thinks you're cheap, and she wants to keep thinking that way. And if I come home and say you gave me a $4.25 tip for a 75-cent ride, she'd be disappointed." So Jack said, "Okay, give me back $4.25. So the cab driver said, no, I think I'll let her be disappointed. Once Jack and I were rushing to, I think, NBC, 10, 15 years ago, and we jumped out of the cab and we rushed to the front door, I thinking he had paid the cab and he thinking I had paid the cab. And we got to the front door, the cab driver yelled, "So it's true about you, Mr. Benny." And Jack looked back and he realized he hadn't paid him. Mm-hmm. And he came back and, of course, gave him like $10 just to say, "Get rid of him."
I think you bring out a little bit in the story of Jack Benny that Mary Livingston, his wife, was no slouch when it came to spending some of his money. She kind of kept that house very well decorated and spent a lot of,
yes,
a lot
Mary,
of money.
Yes, Mary liked the good living, and mm-hmm. she had always had a lovely home and a lot of help, and she liked to serve good food, and she loved lovely clothes. And Jack used to do jokes about it on the stage,
mm-hmm.
about how much money she spent. He used to love to do those jokes. And we used to go to New York. We'd be at a hotel across the street from Bergdorf Goodman, and Jack used to say, "When we arrived in town, Mr. Bergdorf called up and congratulated Goodman."
I congratulate you on a fine book. You know, we know we lost Jack Benny just in December of 74, and the opening page of the book brings it right up front. It begins with the death of Jack Benny, and then there's like a giant flashback through this whole book, and we know at the end we're coming to the death of Mr. Benny and the funeral, and it's like a collision course with that. I didn't want to get to it. I was so involved in the story, and for the first time, I think, that I've ever, whenever reading a book, I sat with the last page with the tears rolling down my face, and I think you really captured them. Well, the essence of Jack Benny.
Well, thank you,
Chuck. Thank you for that.
Thank you. A lot of, I must say, I didn't expect it to get that reaction, but a tremendous amount of people, especially people who knew Jack, mm-hmm. said that they read it and they laughed a lot. They laughed in bed mm-hmm. reading it, and yet they said they cried too. And it's great that I could get that across to people.
Well, I think everybody had a their own personal relationship with Jack Benny, just as you did.
Sure.
And as you were writing about the man, we knew him. We knew him intimately too, I think. And I'm glad that you put it down on paper. And it's available at all bookstores, as they say, by Putnam, Jack Benny, An Intimate Biography by Irving Fine. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Chuck. I appreciated this.